Beauty, everybody,
both in person and on Zoom. Welcome back to Elevating the Spark, exploring the spiritual world of Hasidus. And today we're going to, let me chart a path forward a little bit and sort of bring us back to where we began. Our main path has been, we started by learning about the Baal Shem Tov. He was the founder of Hasidus, the person who really began the movement, started the movement. Last Wednesday night, we learned about one of his main disciples. That was Rav Yaakov Yosef Polonoya, those who were with us. And his main tafkid, you could say, his main mission was to write down the teachings of the Baal Shem Tov, the teachings of Hasidus. The Baal Shem Tov did not write any books. He did not write anything himself. The first to actually write down the teachings of Hasidic thought was the Rabbi Yaakov Yosef of Polonoya, who had his own story we discussed last week. And today, what I'd like to do is to learn a little bit about the life, thought, Torah of another one of the great students of the Baal Shem Tov, the most famous and prominent one, and that is Rav Dov Ber of Mezrich, or the Maggid of Mezrich. Has anyone ever heard of the Maggid of Mezrich? The Maggid of Mezrich essentially is responsible for making Hasidism a movement. Whereas the Baal Shem Tov was a very powerful personality, he was very charismatic, had a lot of revolutionary ideas. The Maggid of Mezrich was the one who took those ideas, started to spread them to his students, who in turn spread them throughout Europe. And very, very quickly, this became a huge movement. So I like to study his life a little bit. Like any other Hasidic rabbi of the time, it's hard to discern between, you know, myth and real history. Do a simple Google search of the Maggid of Mezrich. You'll find a lot of websites that detail all sorts of fantastic stories about him. How much of those are 100% true? How much of that is embellished? I'm not sure. I don't think anyone can be, but what is clear from all those who wrote about him is this was a very unique figure, that encountering him was the experience of a lifetime that changed your life forever. So with that, I'm going to share my slide show, and we will begin. And for those who don't know the slides in front of them, I don't think it will be particularly necessary to follow along. So here we go. Dov Ber of Mezrich, the herald of the Hasidic movement. So I have here, for those who are looking, just a bit of a diagram of how this spread. Again, we have Yisrael Baal Shem Tov, sort of at the top. He began the movement. He had two main disciples, Rabbi Yaakov Yosef Polonoya, who was responsible for writing down the teachings, not as many students. But when the Baal Shem Tov died, or was about to die, there was a big question as to who would be his successor, as it were. And for a brief amount of time, his son was the successor of the leader of the movement, but he didn't have the same qualities or desire to continue. And so there was a big question as to who would pick up the leadership of the movement, and it ended up being Dov Ber of Mezrich, not Rabbi Yaakov Yosef Polonoya, who might have been a greater scholar, but Rabbi Dov Ber of Mezrich was seen as more of a leader, someone who could lead a flock. He had many very prominent students. Maybe you've heard of some of them. Have you heard of Chabad Hasidus? Heard of Chabad? So the master of Chabad, the first Hasidic grandmaster of Chabad, was Rishir Zalman of Laivi, called the Baal HaTanya otherwise. He was a student of the Maggid of Mezrich. Rav Levi Yitzchak of Bardichev. Maybe you've heard some stories of Levi Yitzchak of Bardichev. He's very well known. I hope to study some of his thought, which is often more accessible. But Rav Levi Yitzchak of Bardichev was a student of the Baal Shem Tov. Rav Elimelech of Vyshansk, who really brought Hasidus to Poland, was also a student of the Rav Dov Ber of Mezrich. So he had many students who themselves started their own Hasidic sects after his life. So let's learn a little bit about him. We don't know too much about his upbringing, but we do know some. He was born in Lukács, Volhynia. I'm not sure I'm pronouncing that right. Volhynia was a province in what is now Western Ukraine, which was right in the middle of Eastern Europe. So it was close to Poland, to Lithuania, to Russia, to Belarus, which ended up being important because in this way, though Berev Mezrich was able to really access Europe and to spread the teachings of Hasidus. But like other students of the Baal Shem Tov, he did not start off as a Hasid. He was born in a very prominent rabbinic family. There's a legend of a burnt down house when he was young at the age of 5. Again, he came from a very prominent rabbinic family that wasn't particularly wealthy. And the legend goes that his house burned down at the age of 5. And the legend goes that he saw his mother was crying and she was so distraught. And he asked his mother, well, why are you so sad? And she said that what really aggrieved her the most was they had a family tree in the house, which traced their lineage through Rabbi Yochanan HaSandlar, which is one of the Tanaim, all the way back to King David. And they had lost this family tree, which traced their lineage all the way back to King David. And Dov Berev Mezrich said to his mother, why are you so worried? I will start a new family tree for us. Our descendants will trace our lineage back to me. So goes the legend of Dov Berev Mezrich at the age of 5. So that being said, he was a really strong student, a Talmudic prodigy. He was a student of the Pnei Yehoshua. Those who studied Talmud may be familiar with that name. It's a very well-known work on the Talmud. One of the primary Talmidei Chachamim of his time, and he was a Talmudist. As he grew older, he also began to study Kabbalah, and his profession was that of Magid. That's an interesting one. Nowadays, the rabbi is almost like a jack of all trades, right? So the rabbi's job is to answer questions. The rabbi's job is to take care of people's needs, pastoral needs, to give halachic discourses, etc. In that time, that was not so. The rabbi's job was primarily to answer halachic questions, and every once in a while, they might give a halachic discourse. But sermons, the responsibility of preaching and inspiring people and delivering sermons was not that of the rabbi, it was that of a magid. A magid was someone who would deliver sermons and inspire the people and preach. And Dov Berev Mezrich became a Magid. That's why it's called the Magid of Mezrich. And he served in many different communities in Europe as a professional preacher. Now, there's a fascinating snippet of history we have about the Magid of Mezrich and his skillful preaching from Salmon Maimon. This is why it's really interesting. Salmon Maimon was someone from the Haskalah, the Enlightenment. You heard of the Enlightenment? He was someone who grew up in a traditional family, but really became very tied up with the study of philosophy. He met Moses Mendelssohn. He was very impressed by the Enlightenment in Germany. But he also had an interest in Kabbalah. And Salmon Maimon, due to this interest, wanted to visit the Magid of Mezrich. And he writes down his experience. And after visiting the Magid of Mezrich, and what's fascinating about it is he was no proponent of Hasidus. He wasn't like supportive of the Magid generally, but he describes him as follows. He says, on Shabbos, I came to a magnificent feast in the Tzaddik's house, the Magid, with a group of distinguished people from various regions. Later, the Tzaddik himself appeared in all his glory, a distinguished looking man. He aroused awesome respect in the hearts of all who beheld him. He was dressed in white satin with white shoes. Even his snuff box was white. After he greeted his guests, we sat at the table. Throughout the meal, a holy silence pervaded. Afterward, the tzaddik began to sing an uplifting melody. Right? Sounds like a rebbe, like at a tish, he's singing. He placed his hand on his brow in contemplation. Started thinking, just thinking. Then he identified each guest by name and hometown. Sounds pretty skillful. We were amazed. He knew everybody's name and where they came from. The tzaddik asked each one of us to say a verse from the Bible. Right? He went around the table. You tell me a verse from the Bible. Tell me a verse from the Bible. He proceeded to expound skillfully combining the various verses, which is to say, instead of having pre-prepared remarks, he asked people to quote random sukkim from Tanakh And he weaved them together in his discourse at that table Friday night. That was how skilled he was. Even more astounding in the part of the discourse related to our respective verses, we discovered specific allusions to our private life and thoughts. So in each verse, he alluded to something special about the people that were there. So this is what Solomon Maimon writes in his autobiography about the Magen of Mezrich. So a very talented person. Like other students of the Baal Shem Tov, the story of how he met the Baal Shem Tov is also enshrouded in legend. So it goes like this. In 1753, which was about 9 years before the Baal Shem Tov passed, and 18 before the Magen of Mezrich passed, he was sick. The Magen of Mezrich was someone who was very dedicated to his studies to the detriment of his physical health. He had physical ailments. He was lame with one of his feet. And he didn't make it better by always learning and not attending to his physical needs. So the Rabbi Yoshua Falk, who was his rabbi, again, a great Talmudic scholar, told him to go see the Baal Shem Tov. Baal Shem Tov was known for healing. He could heal people. That's what a Baal Shem was, someone who could heal. Okay, so what happens? He goes to the Baal Shem Tov, this big, famous rabbi, preacher, chassid, and he wants to meet this person, and he was someone who was very particular about his time. Didn't want to waste time, but he said, okay, I was told to go see him. Fine, so he goes to see him. He meets the Baal Shem Tov. The Baal Shem Tov tells him a story about horses. And he's like, this is what I came to see? This guy's telling me a story? Like, this is ridiculous. He tries to meet him a second time. Same thing happens. Tells him like a simple story. So he's really upset. He's like, this is ridiculous. I traveled all the way here to Mezhebuzh, 175 miles away from where he lived. And now this fool is just telling me stories. Like, this is ridiculous. Why'd I waste my time? And before he left, before he could leave, the Baal Shem Tov sent him a messenger and said, before you leave, I'd like you to meet the Baal Shem Tov one more time. So he goes to see the Baal Shem Tov. The Baal Shem Tov asks him, do you know Torah? So Dover Mezrich says, yeah, of course I know Torah. Yeah. He says to him, do you know Kabbalah? Right? Mysticism. Have you studied the teachings of the Ari? He says, yeah. So here's the story goes. And now I'm reading from the passage from Chabad.org. Where Dover carefully examined the passage. He shows him a passage in the Eitz Chaim, which is the work of the Ari HaKadosh, Kabbalistic work. He examined the passage and offered his interpretation. The Baal Shem Tov rejected his words. He says, that's not what it means. You're wrong. Rav Dober deliberated again and reiterated his previous statement. He says, this is what it means. And if you disagree, tell me what you think and we'll see who's right. At this stage, the Baal Shem Tov read the passage to him. As the Baal Shem Tov read and spoke, it seemed to the Magid as though the whole house had become full of light, a divine fire surrounded them. It appeared to the Magid as though he actually saw the angels whose names were mentioned in this course. Afterwards, the Baal Shem Tov said, you were right. Your interpretation was correct, but there is no soul in your learning. No soul. This is what convinced the Magid of the Baal Shem Tov's greatness. After he taught him this passage of Eitz Chaim and the room filled up with light. And you have many of these sorts of descriptions of the Magid himself when he taught. So at this point, the Magid of Mezrich became a great student of the Baal Shem Tov. From what we understand, he met him twice. He met him two times, one time, that time, and then he met him a second time and stayed with him for 6 months straight. And then they began to correspond. And when the Baal Shem Tov died, the story goes, his disciples went to him and said, our master, how could you leave us? And he responded, there is a bear in the forest. And that was an allusion to Dover. Dover means a bear. Dover of Mezrich. This was to be his successor. And Yaakov Yosef Polonoya, again, who we learned about last week, said that when the Baal Shem Tov died, the Shechina, the divine presence, packed her bags and moved from Mezhebuzh to Mezrich. That the Shechina went from where the Baal Shem Tov was to where the Magid of Mezrich was. And again, as I mentioned, his disciples became Hasidic masters in their own right, spread throughout Europe. They included Rav Eli Melech of Lezhansk, Rav Zusha, Rav Nachum Mendel of Vitebsk, Rav Lev Yitzchak Barditchev, Rav Aaron of Karlin, Rav Shneur Zalman of Vilna, the first Chabad Rebbe, So he had a lot of very prominent disciples in his own room. That's a little bit about the Baal Shem, the Magen of Medrash's life. We'll get to what happens toward the end of his life, toward the end of our lecture. Let's now reflect upon some of his teachings. Here we go. So the first thing I'd like to share with you, again, and I apologize for this, is sort of the way it goes with Hasidus. A lot of this is sort of lofty and theoretical, and it can easily go over our heads. But I'd like to try to see what we can take from it, even if we're not Kabbalists, even though I'm not certainly a Kabbalist. So the first thing he talks about is almost like a difference between confidence, the balance between confidence and humility, and specifically balancing our pride in the way we live, our pride in doing mitzvot, and our appreciation of what it means to do a mitzvah and how amazing that is, and balancing that with not letting it get to our head. So here's what he writes. Here I have a little bit of the Hebrew, I have the translation. And again, it's a brief quote, so those who don't have the text in front of them shouldn't be too much of an obstruction. He writes as follows. Sarech l'chol adam yot lo emuna gedola. Every person has to have great faith. Now you think of great faith, what do you think great faith means? Great faith in God, great faith that Hashem runs the world. That's not the type of great faith he's talking about here. So every person needs emunah gedola bazeh, shemizeshu osel lumata, mitorer tanug gadol le'em. A person has to have great faith in the impact of their action. A person has to have great faith that when they do something down here in this world, it causes great joy to God in the upper worlds. That my mitzvah, as it were, somehow brings God joy. I have to believe that. And that's really important before I do a mitzvah. He says, Lo Yomar. Don't say, Eich efshar shani yoseh tanuk kivyachol eila. How can I give? What am I? I'm a simple human being of flesh and blood. I should give pleasure to God in the upper world. Don't say that, he says. You have to have great belief, faith in the power of your actions. Rak b'chol asiyat ha-mitzvah. Whenever a person does a mitzvah, yasho, sheyiyeh tanuk gadol le'ela. He should think that there will be great pleasure on high. Sheyavi kol hadvarim le'olam matanu. This is a very cryptic statement. And by doing so, he'll bring everything to the place, that world of pleasure. Desham lo haya hashvira. There is no breaking of vessels. Something I referred to last week. So I want to focus on two things in the statement. And let's reflect on this for a second. Why is he emphasizing this notion that we have to believe that when we do a mitzvah, that there's great pleasure on high, that God in some way receives some sort of pleasure, right? After all, we know that we don't know what would it mean for God to have pleasure. What is God lacking such that needs pleasure? Why is he focusing on that? What do you think? What could that mean? Or why think about that? That God has pleasure when I do a mitzvah. What's the emphasis there? I think Rose is saying something, but I think you're on mute.
Can you hear me now?
Yeah.
Thank you. I think it connects us to Hashem. It creates a reciprocal relationship with Hashem.
Right. That's the radicalism of Hasidut. One part of it. The idea that there's a reciprocal relationship, beautifully expressed. Classically, we think of in our relationship with God that God is the giver. We are only the receiver. But in mysticism, in Hasidut, it's reciprocal. In some way, whether that means in terms of his influence in the world, his interaction with the world, but in some way, By doing a mitzvah, I'm giving God happiness. I'm giving to Him. What that means philosophically, I am not 100% sure, but that's the approach that the Maggid is advocating for us. And the power of that is it gives almost unlimited power to our actions. It means everything that I do is so impactful that if I can make God happy, so to speak, by doing a mitzvah, then what does that? How does that affect the way I approach a mitzvah? How does it affect the importance I give to it? How much time I spend reflecting upon it, connecting to it? That it's that important. Every mitzvah that I do, I'm giving God joy. And there's another element here which I want to reflect upon again. And it's hard to sort of to really understand it, but I do think we do have something to gain from it. And that as he talks about this world of the light. Now, I don't know what the world of the light really is. I don't. I'm not a Kabbalist. What that refers to, the world of the light. What I do think is what he's saying, talking about to some degree, is transcendence. Transcendence. The notion that this physical world that we live and see in, this physical world that's full often of despair, of sadness, of pain, of things that we don't understand, this physical world isn't the be-all and end-all of existence. And that there is a world or many worlds that transcend this world, spiritual worlds. And in those, there is a place of pure delight. But we don't access it naturally in this world. We don't access it. We live in a world of not pure delight. Far from it. But if a person clears their mind, if a person concentrates appropriately and mentally and emotionally prepares themselves, they can connect to that world. They can connect to that place. They can transcend the reality we are subject to in this world. And that is a huge theme of Chassidus. And what it does is it gives hope to those in this world who don't experience pure joy and delight. And it helps you inject spirituality into everything. Because if I could be connected to a spiritual world wherever I am, I don't need to be bound by the very physical, mundane surroundings that I live in. So on the one hand, he says here, every mitzvah gives delight upon high. But then he says, okay, so if I think that everything I do is so amazing, what's that going to lead to? I'm going to think I'm worth $1 million. I'm amazing. I'm so wonderful. I do all these things that give God joy. So he couples this with the following. Pen Yomar Billy Bo, says the Maggid. I should just add, this excerpt is from a work called Maggid Varav Yaakov, which wasn't written by the Maggid directly, but it was published very soon after his death by a Rav Shlomo of Lutsk, who was a disciple of the Maggid and attempted to remember some of his discourses and write them down. So that's where this comes from. He says, Pen Yomar Billy Bo Shu Tzadik Gadol V'Yavol Yigadot. Lest the person think, well, I'm so great. Look at all the wonderful things I'm doing. And come to a certain haughtiness. Azeh Amar, he's quoting a pasuk from Yechezkel. Maybe you recognize this pasuk from Yechezkel. We say it every year at the Seder. At some point in the Seder, we're in the middle of Maggid. You're starting to nod off at this point. And we start quoting this very graphic verse from Yechezkel where it says that Revava Kitzamachat Sadeh, I have made you numerous as the grasses of the field. You have increased and grown and become very beautiful. And it describes that in graphic detail. And then it says, but before, V'at Arom V'erya, you are beautiful now, but you were naked and bare. Right? It's the personification of Israel. That's that pasuk. And the pasuk personifies Israel as if it were a young woman growing into her beauty. But we started off naked and bare. And he says, where did you get all this from? Who gave you this power? Who gives you this ability to do all these amazing things with mitzvot? It was I. Who gives you the strength? It is I. That coupled with the confidence and pride in what we do, we have to remember where it comes from. It comes from God. And those are two poles we always have to balance with one another. pride on the one hand in what we do, but not to let that get to our head and to remember where it all comes from. It comes from God. It's not from you. But nevertheless, he adds, the main rule is that you must arouse yourself to enthusiasm here on earth and make this your delight in doing the Creator's will. Then you can enter, again, the world of delight. Enthusiasm. Hislahavos. You heard the term hislahavos? Hislahav ahalahav is a fire. Hislahavos might be better translated as being on fire. The Magid wants us to be on fire when we do mitzvah. To be on fire, to be have fervor, to be that enthusiastic, to be that excited when you're about to do a mitzvah. That's the emphasis here. It's not enough just to do a mitzvah. It's not enough just to go through the motions. But you need to have that fervor, that appreciation, that engagement with what you're doing. That's one thought I wanted to share with you from the mind. Two more thoughts, and then we'll close. I know this is heavy, but this one I think should be a bit more approachable. And I want to read the whole quote here. We'll discuss it. The Bein Rishon Esrei, and in many other places, we say the words Elokeinu v'Elokei Avoteinu. Elokeinu, our God, v'Elokei Avoteinu, the God of our forefathers. Why do we always do that? Right? It's the same God, our God, the God of our forefathers. We keep this, hopefully, we worship the same God as our forefathers. So what is the meaning of mentioning it twice? So here the Magid has a very profound philosophical insight. The Magid says, I wrote some about here on the side, there's two forms of faith, of emunah. Maybe you've heard of this before. Two approaches to faith, belief in God. So one approach is basic faith, emunah pshuta, or I believe in this because it's Elokei Avoteinu. It's the God of my forefathers. You know, my great-great-great-grandfather and my grandfather and my grandmother and them and their children and their children and their children all believe in the same God of the Jews of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. And they passed down that faith to me today. And that's my God, the God of my forefathers. That's how I come to believe. That's one approach. The other form or another way a person comes to belief is not through tradition, but through speculation, through arguments, through thinking about the world, through thinking questions like how did this world come to be? How do so many things continue to work in conjunction with one another? And they come to a belief in God through analysis, through inquiry. So which is better? So the Magid says, well, they both have an advantage and a disadvantage. If a person comes to believe through just tradition, it's the God of my forefathers. On the one hand, if a person really has a faith like that rooted deep within them, it's hard to shake that. Because a person can come to you with an argument. You could say, you know what, it doesn't matter. I believe in this because this is the faith I've inherited. They're not particularly interested in engaging in inquiry. That's not what their faith is about. On the other hand, what, of course, is the weakness of just having an inherited traditional faith? What's the flaw of that? Or what could be the flaw? The flaw of believing because our parents believe, and our grandparents believe, and our great-grandparents believe. Flaw, says the Magid of Mezrich, and I found this to be fascinating, coming from a Hasidic grandmaster, the flaw is that maybe we don't really understand it. It's not based in anything. It's not in our intellect. It's not really a part of us. We just believe it because we were always told that's the way it is. On the other hand, a person believes in faith because of reason, and solely because of reason, so then it does become part of them. We do understand it. It's a real connection. But at the same time, there's a weakness there, because if someone comes along with a good argument, a good question, so that faith can be called into question too. So a person has to have both. The Magid of Mezrich says, God is both Elokeinu, our God, the God that I came to know through my own belief, my own thinking, and my own conclusions, and my own inquiry. He's also the God of my forefathers. Also the God I inherited. Also the God that I have a long tradition in believing in. And therefore he concludes, when a person has both these attributes, there is none above him. He strongly relies upon his tradition from his fathers, but at the same time also arrives at faith through his own speculation. This is the best and most perfect kind of faith. And that's why we say our God and the God of our forefathers. Very insightful idea. The combination of the two is the most praiseworthy. I found this fascinating because I would have always thought that in Hasidus, you know, we don't care so much about reason, about inquiry, but it's a balance. It's a balance. And a person needs to be very attuned to the balance in life. Andrew, I want to say something. Brief question? Comment? Okay. Right. Right. Well, that's a different emphasis. I'm talking about faith, but I hear you're right. We also rely not just on what they believed in, but what they did. I hear. I think that's a part of faith. I think it's a part of faith. Yeah. That could be.
Rabbi?
Can you elaborate
on the question? We didn't hear it at this end.
Yeah, the question was, I think it was more of a comment. Andrew was saying, number one, it's not just about what our forefathers and parents believed, but what they did and the way they lived their lives and the challenges they went through, which can be a sort of a booster to our faith. And he also said some of these concepts seem to be sort of common mystical concepts shared by other faiths. Interesting insight. So I want to share one more point with you. And I think it's something that you hear often. Ooh, didn't mean that. I think it's something we hear often, but I think it's important to see it from its source. Let me just go back to that slide. And that is the following. And I bet you'll hopefully be able to guess. 1 second, please. Let me just, I think it's a bit bigger. Slideshow from current slide. Good. So let me ask you briefly. A person's about to do a mitzvah, carry out a halacha, daven, learn. What's the most important thing they need to keep in mind before they do them? The most important part of doing a mitzvah? Very big question. I could have said, make sure you do it right, make sure you get the details right. But that's not the Maggid and Mezrich's answer here. And it's something that we really have to appreciate. Here's what he writes. And this is from Or Torah Avayera. The most important element of observance is the enjoyment one has while doing. The most important element is the simple. Radical statement. Why? We actually see that enjoyment is the main element, that's a typo, that joins two things. Simcha connects. Joy binds things together. For example, a man and a woman are primarily brought together because of their mutual enjoyment of each other. Therefore, when a person observes a commandment, whether in thought, speech, and deed, if it's something I'm thinking, I'm saying, or doing, the most important element is his delight, which connects. It is with this that one binds all the worlds to God. Simcha is for you. Simcha is so important. Why? Not just for no reason, because we just have to always be happy in and of itself. It's because of what is a commandment to me if I don't connect to it? If it's just something I do, but it doesn't connect to a deep part of within me, doesn't become part of who I am, doesn't really get to my kishkes, then what is it? Simcha is what allows that to happen. If we can get to a point of celebration while doing mitzvot, then we can connect to the mitzvot, and in Hasidus, not just connect to what we're doing, not just allow it to become part of us, we can connect to greater world as well. We can connect to God. We connect our entire being to God. Simcha is a connector. And so the most important thing I have to think about is to make sure that I can enjoy the mitzvah that I'm about to do. And I think that's a very inspiring idea, but I think it's a radical one. And with that, I want to sort of lead you to the next thing I think we need to address when the time comes. And that is that you could imagine someone having some trouble with a statement like this, right? Think of the following. A person decides the most important thing about a mitzvah is simple, right? That's the Magen Ezra said. Let's say davening. Davening is very important. And I want to listen to the Magen Mezrich. The Magen Mezrich said the most important thing about davening is simcha, joy. Well, let me tell you, I am not an early riser. And you know what? I don't like to rush in the morning. And the Magen Mezrich said the most important thing about doing mitzvot is simcha. The most important thing. So what I'm going to do is, I'm going to get up at when I want to. I'm going to take my time. I'm not going to rush. I'm going to relax. I'm going to move slowly. I might even have a little bit of something to eat beforehand because I don't want to be hungry the whole time. And finally, when I get around to it and I'm ready, I am going to be besimcha when I daven. And that's what the Magen Mezrich said is the most important thing. The problem, of course, is there are many parameters and halachic rules about when one should daven, should one eat before davening. And if a person is so focused on the emotional experience and the cosmic impact that has, doesn't that run the risk of potentially minimizing the importance of some of the parameters of davening? And so the Magen Mezrich passed away in the 1772, already toward the end of his life, there was great opposition to the Hasidic movement. Great opposition, primarily led by none other than the Vilna Gaon, Rav Eliyahu of Vilna. And Rav Eliyahu of Vilna was, by anyone's imagination, the greatest Tzaddik and Torah scholar of his time. And when he started to learn about some of the tendencies of this movement, the focus on simcha and dancing, and maybe a lack of focus on certain things like Talmudic scholarship or respect for the traditional Torah scholar, and the idea that everybody can connect to God, which might mean that I don't need the great Torah scholars in the same way. And maybe a laxity in certain areas of halachic observance, he was really not happy. And there is a great opposition to the Hasidic movement already at the end of the Magen Mezrich's life, which continued after he died, when the Hasidic movement really split into different sects. So what I'd like to do in our next time we meet together is to study some of the cardinal principles of Hasidus and what the opposition to it was, and maybe to think for a few moments about how much of that opposition was legitimate, how much wasn't so, and what we might learn from that conflict. Anyways, I thank you all for joining us today. Hope you enjoyed. We're going to be off next week. I'm away, but please God, we'll continue in the near future. Thanks, everybody.
Thank you, Rabbi.
Very welcome. Hope you enjoyed. Thanks.
Thank you very much.
You're well. Thank you.
Bye. I said Chavayis. Thanks for coming again. Bye, Verona. Bye, Mari Melinda. Bye, Rose. Bye, Ralph.